we'll be not only talking about, you know, why LGBTs and everyone should support Palestinian rights, but presumably giving us a lot of information about the situation in Israel-Palestine today. Thank you.
Indeed,
very much.
Indeed. Thanks very much, Andy. As Andy said, the news from Palestine today is absolutely dreadful. The particular part of Palestine on the border between Gaza and Israel itself. Over 55 people killed, over 1,200 wounded. This comes on top of already 50 people killed in what have been called the... Can people hear okay? Can you hear okay at the back? Of what have been called the Great Return Marches. Marches for the right of those 1.3 million refugees in Gaza and many, many more elsewhere in the world to return to the homes that they were driven out of or that their grandparents were driven out of. And there was the most obscene contrast between the Israeli armed forces gunning down Palestinian civilians, including women and children, on the one hand, and on the other, the world's rich and some, not all of the governments, gathering in Jerusalem in Al-Quds to open the new American embassy as Trump fulfilled his threat or promise, whichever way you look at it, to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The whole embassy isn't moving, actually, but it is more than a symbolic move, because what that move does is it tears up 70 years of settled international consensus, which is first that Jerusalem, at the point at which Israel and Palestine were partitioned in 1947, 1948, was declared to be a separate entity from both Palestine and Israel. Part of it was to be the capital of Palestine, but Jerusalem was held to be a world historic site which was under international protection. That's completely gone. The second thing that's gone with Trump's move is that the peace process, the Oslo peace process, which began in 1993, people hear the term two states. Yeah, this is goes back to 1993. A critical part of that process was that the status of Jerusalem would be settled at the end of negotiations. Now, we can come on to discuss the whether it was ever viable or feasible for there to be two states, given the given Israeli expansionism. We can come on to discuss that. But what this decision does is tear up what has been American doctrine on the Middle East, on Israel-Palestine, for the last 25 years or more. And another contrast, or perhaps link into this meeting, is that on Sunday night, Israel won the Eurovision Song Contest. Now, I don't know if people watch it here at all. I mean, I don't actually watch it in Europe. But the Eurovision Song Contest is kind of gaudy. It's a very camp of competition. And I don't know if it's actually true that that many lesbians and gay men watch it, but it's held to be true that lots of people watch it because it's so camp and flamboyant and so on. We're all supposed to be so camp and flamboyant. And you might ask yourself, how is it possible for Israel, a country which is in the Near East, on the continent of Asia, even to participate in the Eurovision Song Contest, let alone win the Eurovision Song Contest? And therein lies a key part of what I want to say in the meeting, which is the nature of Israel as a colonial settler state, an extension of Europe into the Middle East, and forged in ways that I want to come on to explain in a few moments. But the Eurovision Song Contest participation fits with an overall policy of trying to normalise the state of Israel, to normalise its land grabs already in 1948, and increasingly to normalise the de facto annexation of large parts of the 22% of historic Palestine, which is what was left to the Palestinians after the 1948 war. If people look, I don't know if people have seen the maps here, you look at the West Bank, which is the most populous area of Palestinians. It's like a kidney shape. And it's been eaten out by these settlements. I mean, these settlements are not just, they're not like a couple of log cabins out in Montana, right? They're new towns and cities, fortified, water diverted to them, roads blocked off. I mean, if anybody challenges you about the relevance of the concept of apartheid to what exists in the West Bank, certainly, you just have to look at the images, just Google them, images of a road which is for Jewish citizens and a road which is for Palestinians. The road which is for Jewish citizens is like a freeway. The road for Palestinians is little more than a dirt track. The attempt to normalise the state of Israel is part of what this meeting is about. But we have to go back, I think, to look at the creation of the state of Israel in the first place. The Zionist movement, and the Zionist movement, well, the way I'm using the term is the political Zionist movement, a movement to create a Jewish nation state, a physical state entity somewhere in the world. The Zionist political movement arose at the end of the 19th century as a response, a rather distorted response, and a minority response to the growth of anti-Semitism in Europe and by extension into North America. It was very, very shocking for people because there had, of course, been anti-Semitism in the Middle Ages, fueled by obscurantist religious ideas of either the Catholic Church or the Protestant Church a bit later. But the birth of liberal democracies, the birth of parliamentarism, the French Revolution of 1789, the gradual extension of the vote in Britain, led people to believe that that kind of monstrous ideology would be buried away in the dark Middle Ages. In fact, it came surging back in a new form, in a form of racism, not a form of religious discrimination. So it didn't make any difference whether you converted from being Jewish to being Christian. The mark of being Jewish was taken to be a racial characteristic. The end result of which, or one end result of which, the most devastating, was of course the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany and the Holocaust. So it was a response, but the response was this. The Zionist leaders said, we have this resurgent anti-Semitism. This shows that even if there's progress in the world, Jews will never be safe among non-Jews. The only way we can be safe is to separate ourselves off and form our own nation state. And they took up the ideas of nationalism in general at the end of the 19th century. Everybody was trying to form their own nation state. Those people who hadn't those people unlike Britain or France or the United States who hadn't forged one already. It was a distorted response, which in a sense took anti-Semitism for granted as the eternal hatred, very pessimistic response. It was also a minority response, because the bulk of the Jewish people in Europe looked in one way or another to the socialist left, and secondly to liberal parliamentarism, if you look at the more middle-class people. So, for example, as late as 1938 in Poland, which is where 3.3 million Jewish people lived, the Jewish Socialist Workers' Bund collective won 70% of the vote. And their slogan was, where we are is where we belong. We are Polish Jews and we're fighting against anti-Semitism in Poland. So the Zionist movement was very much a minority concern, and it had to fight against the more dominant strains inside the Jewish communities, which were socialist to one degree or another, either Labour type or Bundist, like the Polish organisation, or after the Russian Revolution of 1917, significant number of Jewish intellectuals and socialist activists moved in the direction of supporting the Russian Revolution. So that's the first point. The second is, how would it be possible to form this state? Because every previous colonial settler state, like the British in Australia, had been formed as an extension of an already existing state. In fact, the world's number one empire, the number one imperialist power. But there was no such force behind the Zionist movement. So it meant that from the beginning, the Zionist movement, to fulfill its aims, had to find a common ground, an alliance, with one or other of the big imperialist powers. And I'm cutting this short because they tried various of the big powers, from the United States to Tsarist Russia. But it was Britain which decided to sponsor the creation of an exclusivist Jewish state on the historic land of Palestine. Because Britain, towards the end of the First World War, Turkey, the Ottoman Empire is clearly going to lose. The Ottoman Empire had run this multinational empire at one point, stretching all the way from North Africa into the Balkans. And France and Britain carved up these lands, these territories, what are now Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, carved them up in a secret treaty in anticipation of being able to dominate the whole area. And one of the shifts in British policy was to support the Zionist movement's claim to a racially exclusive state in Palestine, a state formed by European settlement of Palestine. There were Jewish people in Palestine, about 20,000, of whom 10,000 were flatly opposed to the creation of a separate Jewish state. And the logic of the British position was summed up by a man who was the first Governor General of Jerusalem, because Britain got the, not quite a colony, but got what was called the mandate to run Palestine after the First World War. A man called Sir Ronald Storrs, who proudly said that he was the first military governor of Jerusalem since the time of Pontius Pilate. So he's obviously not a modest man. But his words summed up the logic very well. He said, "What we are supporting is a little loyal Jewish Ulster surrounded by a sea of potentially barbarous, potentially hostile Arabism." And he knew what he was talking about, because at this time, in 1921, Britain had been forced to retreat from holding Ireland completely as a colony, but had done so by creating this little loyalist Ulster of the six counties of the north of Ireland to divide and rule. And this was the policy of the British throughout the 20s and the 30s. But the Zionist movement is connected to a major imperialist power from the beginning. Something else, which was put by the leaders of the Bund in Poland, which is, they said that if you create a state which excludes the Palestinians or doesn't allow them to belong fully in the economy, and that was the whole mechanism of the creation of the Israeli state, would there'll be Jewish only labor, no Palestinian would be employed in a Jewish firm or enterprise of whatever kind. If you do that, then you will create a hostile population without people who are driven off the land, and an internal hostile population of Palestinians who don't reconcile to be set to be being second-class citizens in this Israeli state. And they said that, isn't this a recipe, rather than for peace and reconciliation and a safe future for Jewish people, isn't this a recipe for permanent antagonism, national chauvinism and racism? And that was in 1938. It was absolutely prescient when you look at what happened afterwards. The British came up with a partition plan several times in the 1940s, but really in 1947, the United Nations, recently formed, agreed to partition Palestine. The Zionist colonization had grown in the course of the 1930s, and then at the end of the Second World War, for very, very obvious reasons, given the Holocaust, the scale of the destruction of the Jews of Europe. I should say that not most Jewish people, even then, would have preferred to go to the United States or Australia or Britain during the late 1930s as the shadow of Hitler is falling across Europe. But the major Western powers held a conference in Evian in France where in 1938 where they decided to close the borders to Jewish emigration. The only emigration that would be allowed would be to Palestine. And even then, the British were kind of on and off with the migration to Palestine because they wanted to use it against the Arabs, but they didn't want to antagonize the Arabs too much that there'd be a general Arab revolt as there had been in 1936. So you have the partition plan, which already is hugely beneficial to the Jewish minority of Palestine, but it's immediately, as independence is declared in 1948, it leads to so-called War of Independence, which is the driving out of 750,000, 800,000 Palestinians from their homes, and large parts of the territory which was supposed to belong to a Palestinian state are taken by force by the advancing Israeli armies. You have a further war in 1967, which brings the West Bank and the Gaza Strip under full occupation of Israel. But when people talk of two states, I think it's quite important to remember there was a plan for two states in 47 and 48. What happened to the plan for two states? It came up against the expansionist dynamic of the Israeli state, an expansionist dynamic which at key points has been beneficial to, first of all, British colonialism and imperial control of the Middle East and French. Britain, France and Israel jointly invaded or tried to invade Egypt in 1956 to overthrow a radical nationalist president. And after 56, after 67 really, it's been critical to how the United States has pursued its interests inside the Middle East. So the two-state solution was there, but founded on these twin realities of an expansionist Israeli state and in alliance with the major Western imperial powers. And one consequence of that has been that over the course of the last 40 years, you've seen a decline in the international standing of Israel compared with the 1960s and 1970s. In the 1967 war between Israel and its neighbours, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, to some extent, Lebanon. In that war, a large number of people on the left around the Western world were sympathetic to the Israeli state because the Holocaust was such a recent phenomenon. We saw only 20-odd years earlier. And that continued into the 1970s. And it wasn't just for that reason. It's also because the dominant political force in Israel, up until the late 1980s, was something called the Israeli Labour Party. Now, the extent to which it can claim to be socialist while excluding Arabs from the state is highly, highly questionable. But at least it had the trappings and the colour of a social democratic party. People could say that Israel is, with these kibbutz, the kibbutzim, is creating a new collective way of working, that it's a more egalitarian society. Again, so long as you ignore the Arabs, said it's more egalitarian amongst the Jews. That was a dominant view all the way through until the early mid-1980s and still remained very, very influential. But precisely because Israel increasingly aligned, dependent upon, principally the United States, but to a far lesser extent, Britain, and this, as predicted, this push to seize more and more Palestinian land, the reality of the state of Israel has clashed with that, very much with that social democratic image. For really, I'd say it began in 1982 with the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, which resulted in the expulsion of the Palestine Liberation Organization from Beirut and also the massacres at the camps of Sabra and Shatila. That was the first time there was a rupture, a crack in the kind of broad social democratic support that Israel had enjoyed up to that point. And now it's really very, very clear. You don't have the Israeli Labour Party. You have the Likud, extremely right-wing party, led by its most right-wing leader ever. And then he is moderate compared with his coalition partners, extreme settler fanatics. And so you can't quite sell the idea that Israel is producing a social democratic society. Okay, we'll get round to do it. We'll have some peace and we'll get round to extending the beneficence of Israel to the Arabs at some point. You can't sell that idea. I mean, look at the news today. You simply can't sell it. And in terms of the international support for Israel, it's not coming from social democratic politicians. They do in Europe. But the principal support for the Netanyahu government is Donald Trump. And so what did we have today to compound the barbarity on the border? We had some Israelis wearing baseball caps saying, "Make Israel great again," straight from the Trump campaign. People should know what that means as well, that there is a strand on the hard right of Israeli politics for whom a greater Israel includes the East Bank of the Jordan. It goes all the way over into Jordan, includes parts of Syria, not just the occupied part of the Golan Heights, and so on. And so it's in that context that we've seen in the last 13 years or so a major effort to rebrand Israel as being socially liberal, surrounded by this sea of barbarous Arabs. And it's not just an Israeli gambit. It comes from the politics in Western Europe and North America post-2001-2003. You have the beginning of the War on Terror and a succession of wars fought by the West, not all of them, but largely, but by the West as a whole, against Muslim-majority countries. And it necessitated an anti-Muslim racism and Islamophobia. It necessitated it even from those who were not stridently racist, weren't going out to disparage Arabs and Muslims. It necessitated it because either you have a good explanation why among 1.5 billion Muslims around the world there is an antagonism with the United States, Britain and France. It's not difficult to see the antagonism. Why might Algerian Muslims feel antagonistic towards France? Well, 1.5 million Algerians were killed in the war of liberation in the country in the 1950s into the 1960s. So either you acknowledge that there is a rational kernel for why it is that there's this hostility, or you say it's irrationalism. The reason they don't like our freedoms. And this didn't start in Israel. It started in France and in the United States. It accelerated massively after 2001. But it provided the critical way for the successive Israeli governments to try to rebrand themselves. And they, when I say rebrand, I use the term, precisely, because in 2005, the Israeli government and culture ministry and so on held a major conference called the Brand Israel Conference. They set out with a marketing strategy to try to show that Israel is this oasis of liberal values. Okay, there may be problems with wars and what have you, but it's in questions of sexuality, questions of the rights of women, it's a liberal society. Incidentally, by accident, it ends up confirming that Israel indeed is a European society. It's a European colonial settler state. That's not what they intended, but it does end up. But it does end up doing that. So you have this Brand Israel conference, $90 million dollars, and it's multifaceted. It's Israeli culture. It's the beaches. And a part of it is that Israel is held up to be a haven for LGBTQs, gay people in the Middle East, that it is far, far better than anything around it. And therefore, this is to the merit, to the credit of the Israeli state. And on that basis alone, or on that basis mainly, you should support it with its annexation of the Palestinians, or perhaps you can criticise that a little bit, but you certainly can't challenge the state challenge the state fundamentally. Now, it's important to recall that although the term pinkwashing was developed for this attempt to put a pink gloss on the Israeli state, the brand Israel process didn't start off with gay people, with lesbians and gay men. It started off with women in a highly misogynistic way. So the advert, one of the first adverts, was women of the Israeli Defense Forces. So you have sexy woman with gun, and this is the image of Israel. Our women are liberated. Look, they can fight against the Arabs too in mixed units. It's a bit like, I'm assuming it is, I don't think I've seen much of it. I'm assuming it's like the NRA's propaganda. You know, I've seen little memes and so on, you know, of some a conventionally attractive white woman with an AK-47 or something. And this is the model of progress. And that, so it's important to remember that, because it was very, very sexist the way that it was put. Second important thing is that the attitude of the Israeli government to gay rights in Israel, leave aside Palestine, in Israel, is extremely contradictory. So Benjamin Netanyahu rarely misses an opportunity on the international stage to mention that homosexuality is legal in Israel. It's actually legal in Palestine as well. The law was overturned in the 1950s. But in Israel itself, his base of support is the hard right and the ultra-Orthodox religious, both of whom are massively anti-gay. As it's summed up by a journalist called Barak Ravid, writing in the Haaretz newspaper, liberal Israeli daily, where he says, Netanyahu does this, but when he's confronted with the demand for the extension of LGBT rights in Israel, he runs from it as if he was on fire. And a professor of law called Ayel Gross put it very, very straightforwardly. He said that in Israel, LGBTQ rights have become a mere public relations device for the propagation of the Israeli state, which is run by people who are not at all sympathetic to LGBT. Nor is it true that the rights that, insofar as they exist, that gay people have got in Israel, have come from above via some enlightened liberal government. It's exactly very similar to here or in Britain or in France or any of the other Western countries, that it was the explosion of the gay LGBT movement which forced governments to decriminalise homosexuality, male homosexuality, forced advances of equality in tax and so on, and then later in civil partnerships and marriage and all the rest of it. So to hold up the limited LGBT rights in Israel as the benchmark of the state and to ignore Netanyahu would be like saying, we'd be like saying that Trump is somehow a representative of gay liberation in the United States, because the movement for gay liberation has registered various successes which even he can't overturn in one simple go. And it would also be like saying, you know, if you say that in Israel there's limited advances for gays, and therefore that outweighs, or it can be put on the balance, with the dispossession of the Palestinians driven from their homes, the repression, the tearing up of the two-state solution, and so on. That would be a bit like saying, Well, the fact that the Supreme Court granted equal marriage in the United States means we don't have to care that much about the number of black people killed every week by the police. It would be a pink patina on the reality of the state. And that's very much the case in the case in Israel. I'm going to spell that out a bit now. First of all, it's important to recognise that the rights are highly limited. So, for example, the Israeli Supreme Court last year did not grant same-sex marriage. And as a consequence, there's only the most limited state recognition of same-sex relations. The reason for that is that the Jewish church, the rabbis, have a monopoly upon officiating at marriage, at marriages. So you don't have political or civil marriage, you know, where you can go to, I don't know, you go to the town hall or something like that, or the mayor can marry you and so on. You can't have that in Israel. It's part of the compact of it being a Jewish state with a role for the organized Jewish faith. So you don't have that. And the images that you see of, you know, nightclubs, beaches in Tel Aviv, which are predominantly male images, by the way. This is quite important to recognize. If you think about lesbian liberation in Israel and encouraging it as a lesbian destination for tourism, it's far, far less. We're talking very much prioritizing, privileging gay men in this enterprise. But you're talking about places which are very much the minority of the country. You know, you can have a gay beach and a gay bar. That is not reflective of the overall society. Now, there are liberal Israelis. There are people who've supported the fight for LGBT rights. There's, I think, 65 or 70% of people in Israel say that they're in favour of equal marriage. But one consequence of these succession of wars and leading now to the alliance with Donald Trump and the sights turned on Iran has been to increase the hard right base of Israeli society. It's also increased through demographic means, which is that the ultra-Orthodox families generally have something like 8 or 10 children, whereas the more secular Jewish families have two or three children. So there is a real dysfunctionality of Israeli society. It has a westward-oriented face trying to present these niches of, you know, we can go to a gay bar or go to a nightclub or what have you. That oriented to the West, at the same time, within Israeli society itself, those things are massively contested and increasingly contested. So you see all sorts of attacks on pride demonstrations, either physical or political attacks, by the ultra-Orthodox. And there's a mechanism which generates that, which is the settlements. Because the more these settlements are built, surrounded by Palestinians, the more they're fortified, the more it necessitates an extreme racism and a reactionary set of ideas in general. So you find the settlers extremely racist about the Palestinians, also highly reactionary on the rights of women, the rights of LGBT people, and so on. There's another myth to this, which is that it's only in Israel and not in Palestine that there's been any agitation by activists for gay liberation, for LGBTQ liberation. That's not true. I mean, there's an organisation, Palestinian Queers for BDS, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions. There's Aswat, Al-Kawz, three Palestinian gay, queer organisations. And they have battled against the twin problems which are related. The Israeli occupation, or in the case of the siege on Gaza, the siege, itself, of course, is massively damaging to the Palestinians. But the other thing that it does is it disrupts the development, the free development of Palestinian society. It strengthens reactionary forces, reactionary currents inside those societies. And it's not just Israel that's done this. If you go back to the colonial period, the mandate period in the Middle East, or the colonies in Africa, where do you find countries such as Uganda or in Lebanon, which is repealed it, where did these anti-gay laws come from in the colonies? They came from the colonial powers. I mean, the French were extremely distressed when they rolled up into Lebanon to find two things. Large numbers of women working in Beirut in the tobacco industry, which had a social consequence, which is that the woman was the main breadwinner in several households, which changed the whole relations between the sexes, not across the country as a whole, but, you know, inside that part of the Lebanese working class. That was the one thing they didn't like. The other thing they didn't like was the hammam, the bathhouse. It's not quite the same as the bathhouse here, but the Turkish bath, where men would be together intimately and so on. This was shocking to the European imagination. So they closed the bathhouses, and they also imported a women's magazine, French women's magazine, which developed in the 1920s, the era of consumerism and so on. This is when all these women's magazines really take off. They import this wholesale, desperate for Lebanese women to read about how to be a good housewife and not going out to the factory. So the complete myth is that there has always been a progressive West on these questions and a reactionary East. Now, of course, there's been reaction in the East. Of course, that's true. But if you look back to before the colonial period, you find a much more complex relationship, a set of understandings of homosexuality inside the Middle East. You also find that in Africa. I've not got time to go through it. But one of the great crimes that this whole argument commits is this cultural essentialism that Muslims and the Arabs and Africans are inherently reactionary on these questions. In fact, you find in French and British literature both shock and fascination among white European civil servants and colonial administrators at the very different and complex understandings of sexuality in India, in Egypt, and in other countries. If people haven't read it, I strongly recommend you do. It's a major theme of Edward Said's book on Orientalism, dismantling these ideas. Just a few final points. I think it gets even more reactionary than that, because you end up with a view. There's a claim that Palestinians can come to Tel Aviv and be out as gay, and therefore it provides a refuge for them. Now, very few Palestinians can or do that, but that whole claim is associated with a real racialization of the politics of sexuality and sex. It's there in the imagery, promoting Israel as a gay destination, certainly there in the erotica and pornography, which is that the Arab man is simultaneously oversexed but also more repressed than the Jewish man. And that plays out in all sorts of ways. I say I'm talking about men because really the women really don't get a look in over this. There's not much pressed over the question of lesbian liberation. Now, just to kind of wrap that up a little bit, the fundamental point, I think, has to be this, that as in South Africa, where there was a white-led gay movement, it is impossible to talk about gay liberation, LGBT liberation, when there is such a glaring racial divide and more than half the population are oppressed on that basis. And it is now more than half the population. Between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, There are now, according to the Israeli army's estimate, and they estimate these things very, very accurately, there are now 6.4 million Jewish people and 6.8 million Palestinian people living as second-class citizens or under occupation or under siege. And so the idea that in the equivalent of white South Africa, that you could fight for gay liberation or even equal rights without taking up the fundamental disfigurement of the society, which is the racial division, I think is absolutely hopeless. And there are some Israeli LGBT activists who do recognise that. They are more pro-Palestinian. They're at least for some equality. They're at least for what they would see as a viable two-state solution and so on. But that's not the position of the Israeli Tourism Board, the LGBT Film Festival that happens in Israel, which gets its money from the Culture Ministry, and part of the funding from the Culture Ministry is that the film festival will not criticise the state of Israel. So imagine, you know, we're fighting the big battle for sexual freedom and sexual liberation on the dime of the Netanyahu's Culture Ministry, who insists that we can't say something about the fundamental question, which affects the whole country. And that's the first point. The second point is that there is hope for an advance for lesbian and gay rights in the Middle East, but it will have to come as a part of the struggle against the historic disfigurements of the Middle East, the subordination to Western interests, one consequence of that, the promotion of one dictatorship or authoritarian regime after another. This is part and parcel of the question of divide and rule. And so it's the processes of struggle on the social question, on the question of peace, not war, that can create an environment in which the LGBT question can be raised as well. The very final thing I want to say is that the idea that the pinkwashing idea really comes crashing down when you consider that in the shift that's taking place in Middle Eastern politics now and has done over the last year, the closest Arab ally of Israel is Saudi Arabia. Now, a 16-year-old woman from the United Arab Emirates has just been lashed some unbearable amount of times because she was gang raped in Saudi Arabia. I mean, it is absolutely barbaric. Yet Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, are absolutely committed to an alliance directed against Iran and an alliance with Trump. And I think that I think that one example shows you how this whole claim about Israel and LGBT rights has not been about even celebrating those rights that have been won. It's been about instrumentalising the question, which shouldn't be instrumentalised, it's a question in its own right, for purposes of the sustaining of the Israeli state, its interests in the United States. Thanks, Andy. 2005 is both the year of the BDS and the counterattack. And it's not just pinkwashing. The Israeli government has recognised what it refers to as an existential threat to it by the BDS movement. And one of the reasons for that is because the movement to boycott, divest from and sanction Israel speaks to universal values, yet pitches itself around the right to return, the right to equality, about righting the historic injustice, all of which is recognised in international law. And that has traction increasingly around the world, notwithstanding Ivanka Trump, you know, putting a plaque, or going to put the plaque on the embassy wall in Jerusalem. So, for example, in the United States, an increasing number of young Jewish people say that they refer to Israel as them rather than us, and also say that Israel should be held to the same universal standards of account as any other state, which is a major shift. And so the official Jewish organizations, pro-Likud, pro-Netanyahu organizations, are increasingly out on a limb compared with, not necessarily a socialist view, but compared with a deeply human view, which is growing around the world. And so, yeah, the big pushback, pinkwashing, the attempts to break the cultural boycott in particular, began in 2005. I have to say that they're losing ground. When we were talking at the beginning, Paul, and the Methodist Church in Britain has adopted a full BDS position, and so have some other churches. A couple of days ago, the government had responded to attempts by local government, local councils, to raise boycotting Israel by declaring that illegal. Well, a High Court judge in London squashed that and said it is legal to boycott Israel. And that will probably open up a number of avenues to try and pursue that. The government's going to appeal, but I'm not at all confident that they will be able to win it. In British public opinion, 66% of people now have a negative or very negative view of the state of Israel, which is historically enormously high. So I think that's the kind of battleground, and it is a propaganda war, except that the BDS is also a material war, because it really does make a difference if acts pull out from Israel, if there's the academic boycott, if companies feel that they will lose business in the much bigger markets of the United States and the European Union, if they don't at least pull out of the occupied settlements. And we want it to go much further than that. But that's the position of the British trade union movement, the TUC, is for a boycott of companies which do business and make money out of the illegal settlements. On the point about it being not just Trump, that's absolutely true. I mean, it began before 1967, but really 1967 is a major turning point. The United States, by far the dominant global power, and Israel demonstrating in the Six-Day War that it had the capacity to be very useful militarily as well as useful politically inside the Middle East. Now, that said, I think there is if not a shift, then a development which is taking place at the moment, because there's always been tensions between the United States and Israel. You know, people talk of the Israel lobby as if the Israel lobby determines US policy against the interests of the United States. In fact, it's the other way around. The United States policy has been formed, and an extension of that is to support Israel because it's been seen to be in the interests of the United States. But that doesn't mean that the particular interests of an Israeli government and of the US state always coincide. I mean, I'll give you one example which, you know, is quite surprising, really, which is in 2001, George Bush announced that there would be a roadmap to peace in the Middle East, a roadmap to Palestinian nationhood, statehood. This is immediately after 9/11. And he did it for a very simple reason, to try to build the widest coalition at that point for the war on Afghanistan. Were less kind of fussy about having a wide coalition when it came to the war on Iraq. But this was very important for them, drawing Arab leaders. Ariel Sharon, the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, said, we're not having a roadmap to peace, we're not having a roadmap to Palestinian statehood, and launched a massive incursion into the West Bank. Now, it's not true that Israel and the US came to blows fully. I describe it as kind of at points it's been in recent years an unhappy marriage with neither partner prepared to sue for divorce. I mean, the Israelis can't sue for divorce. Israel is completely dependent, massively dependent upon the United States. And this came to a head under Obama. It wasn't because Obama was terribly liberal. It was because Netanyahu was and is terribly obnoxious, and refused to grant anything in terms of scaling back the settlement building program, making any gesture at all. And this famously underlay the froideur, the tension between Obama and Netanyahu. And it was summed up by John Kerry, Obama's Secretary of State, in December of 2016, his final public speech in that office, where he excoriated Netanyahu in terms of an American politician, not in our terms, but in terms of a mainstream American politician. And he made an observation. He said that either Israel can be a Jewish state or it can be a democratic state, but it can't be both if you abandon the two-state solution, because more and more Arabs will be drawn into the borders of Israel, and they will, in order to control them, it will mean keeping them as second-class citizens, so you won't have a democratic state. Now, it's quite an extraordinary thing for someone like John Kerry to say, and he said it in justification for why the US had very rarely, had on one of the rare occasions, used its veto to, veto a UN Security Council resolution condemning the settlement building program. Netanyahu said this is tantamount to the Holocaust, the fact that the United States has allowed this to go through. But that showed some of the tensions. Now, there's different ways of resolving those tensions. Trump's is one. Trump's way of resolving the tensions is to move very, very close to Likud and to Netanyahu, to adopt their positions as American positions in the policy-making process in the United States. So while the Israel lobby doesn't determine policy, Trump has prioritized the relationship with Israel, and that is now feeding back inside all sorts of frictions inside the state itself, because it's still arguable that what the United States could really do with is at least the fig leaf of a peace process, which it could then use to keep King Hussein of Jordan on board, which General Sisi could use to say that something is being done to our Palestinian brothers and sisters, and so on. To rip that out and go for this course of confrontation, a war drive, whether it leads to war or not, we don't know, but a war drive with Iran. You do that and you remove the fig leaf of some kind of United States interest in achieving justice for the Palestinians. We know it was a fig leaf. But if you remove that, things become very, very unstable indeed. So I think there is a development with Trump. That's not to say, you have to be careful. In focusing on Trump, we don't want to whitewash all that's gone before. Trump's policy is a development of American policy, and the Obama policy had failed. Trump's is a development, a right-wing turn, very aggressive and pro-Netanyahu, but it emerges from the failure of the Obama policy. On the question of the Pulse shooting and how we make these arguments, I think one argument to make is that the more that people in the West say that sympathy for gay rights or homosexuality itself as being regarded as in some way normal or acceptable, the more people in the West say that that is uniquely Western, the more it strengthens all the reactionary forces in Asia and in Africa who also want to say it's uniquely. I mean, often these people are clinging to legal codes which date from the British and French colonial period in Africa. That was the case in Uganda, for example. And one thing which helps them is if Western activists are saying, yes, it is. It's a Western thing, this homosexuality. Well, that means the Ugandan government says, well, yeah, that's right, so we don't want it. We kicked out the colonizers, we kicked out the imperialists, and we're not having advance for homosexual rights. So that's one argument to make, I think, Brent, against the tendency to see just a massive reaction in the Muslim world. If you want to unite people behind reaction, then say that a fundamental aspect of humanity is actually uniquely Western, and has always been condemned in the Middle East. That's one way to do that. I'll leave that there, I think. Just on Roger's point, I have heard that argument, but it isn't true. The plan was to colonize Palestine, which meant denying very, very often that there were Palestinians living in Palestine, an empty land without a people for a people without a land. But the mechanism, what do you do when you land in Haifa and you set up your family, your colons, literally a colony, you know, like the British at Jamestown, you know, excluding the people living here and having a closed economy. And if you do that, and it was central to the what was called the era of the Jewish, exclusively Jewish society come state that they were trying to build, the Palestinian labor is excluded, so no Jewish enterprise would employ a Palestinian. So in order to do that, you have to enforce the strictest of racial separations. The Jewish product was defended. So Jewish people boycotted the Arabs. They bought only from Jewish suppliers. So you create a parallel society. It's a minority society. It's not an oppressed society. It's a colonizing society, which gradually pushes out large numbers of Arabs. And the idea of state building was there right at the very beginning of the political Zionist movement, because they actually adopted the general thinking of European nationalists with a particular twist, quite a reactionary twist. A lot of the Zionist leaders said that the Jewish people of Europe could not be complete, that they would be effete, that they would not be able to be a proper nation unless they were constituted into a nation state. And quite really reactionary ideas, so that Jews needed to get on the land and work hard as agricultural labourers, and this would toughen up the Jewish race, which would otherwise be intellectual and cosmopolitan in Vienna and Berlin and so on. These were arguments that Herzl made. A kind of ethnic nationalism, albeit as a response to anti-Semitism, with the construction of a nation state, fully fledged nation state. Now, what did radicalise in the 1930s was, because there was opposition from the Arabs, which kind of ebbed and flowed, and the British tried to balance in between, but usually coming down on the side of the Zionist movement, it opened the door to a more radically right-wing formation than the Israeli Labour Party. Jabotinsky, the so-called the Iron Wall, the forerunner of Likud. See, for a lot of the Israeli Labour Party leaders were terribly racist, but for a lot of the average people supporting the Israeli Labour Party, it was, look, we need to separate, form our own state, and then we'll have peace with the Arabs. And our advances with these kibbutzim, the economic advances, the fact that we have a democracy, albeit essentially a Jewish democracy, this will be a light amongst the nations. This will be a light amongst the Arabs. This is what a lot of people believed who fought in the, as you mentioned, the literally the terror gangs, because I'm not using that moralistically, it's a good description of what the Stern Gang and the others did in the 1940s. That people who fought in that thought that, okay, there'll be bloodshed and so on, but then we will establish the state and it will lead to democratization elsewhere in the Middle East. There's a book by a man called Maxim Gilan, who was one of those fighters. He wrote it in 1972, and the title is How Israel Lost Its Soul. So already by 1972, this dream of a socialist, this Labour Zionist, socialist Zionist dream was beginning to falter. And that brings me to the second question, which is this radicalisation to the right of Israeli politics. Well, to be honest, if you fight one war after another against the Palestinians, you generate a radical right. I mean, how do you justify the oppression of the people of Gaza? You have to have an increasingly racist and chauvinist line. It's also the case that the internal decomposition of Israeli politics means that the far-right forces based upon the settlements have a great leverage, as do the ultra-Orthodox, as I mentioned in the introduction. So in terms of, in response to your question, you have a range of Israeli parties. The Likud actually lost ground at the last election, but it was forced into a coalition with even more right-wing forces. the Israeli Labour Party is kind of repositioning its, it's much weaker than it used to be. It's repositioning itself with various centrist figures. But there is a dysfunctionality of Israeli society. Because if you're in a state of permanent war, then authoritarian, racist, sexist, anti-gay ideas become generated at home. Look at the United States. You know, if you, the more that you have these wars projected abroad, the more it generates all those kinds of reactionary forces. And that's really what's happened in Israel. After the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, signed up to Oslo, you've then seen a long retreat, sometimes quite rapid, from the Oslo Accords by the Israeli government. And I suppose the difference with Trump now is that Trump is embracing the Netanyahu position, which is that there will be, there will not, which is that there will not be a Palestinian state. I mean, if you, it used to be a couple of years ago that for those of us who believed in one single state in which Jews and Arabs would live together, it used to be put to us that the two, that we denied the two-state solution, that that was the realistic solution. Now, with the facts on the ground and the abandonment by Trump and Netanyahu of the peace process, actually the two-state solution, so far as it ever was one, stands as a rebuke to them. They're creating one state, in reality. The question is, what kind of state will it be? Will it be a democratic state, or will it have an entrenched apartheid, and 48% of people in Israel, of Jews in Israel, in favour of the transfer of the Palestinians, which means uprooting people from the West Bank and from Israel itself, over into Jordan. So the slogan of the Israeli right is, there is a Palestinian state, it's on the east bank of the Jordan River. Now, the only way that you can do that, that you can move millions of people, is in conditions of near total war and of massive ethnic cleansing, like in 47, 48, but on an even bigger scale. So that's the prospect that's being held out by these people as they pinkwash and say, you know, you can go and have a great gay weekend in Tel Aviv. Meanwhile, it's not just the Palestinians who are suffering, it's Israeli society is locked into this course with more and more to the right. I say society, it's more the politics. In the society, there are people trying to pull in the opposite direction. And everything we do here to counter the propaganda, counter the pinkwashing and so on, is an additional strength to them. Voilà.